he says that rule applies equally to schools as it does to playgrounds.
Wow.
And
And when he says schools, he's not talking about school playgrounds.
Yeah.
He's talking about schools and what they teach, and specifically the religious schools.
Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith, freedom for all in this tumultuous 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm BJC General Counsel Holly Holman.
This week, we're going to take a look at a recent Supreme Court case and how it could impact faith, freedom for all. We'll talk through the facts and arguments at play in Espinosa versus Montana Department of Revenue. In our second segment, we'll talk about the potential impact of the case as it relates to expansion of state voucher programs and religious liberty law more broadly. And be sure to stick around for our third segment when we share what we are seeing, reading, watching, and thinking about when it comes to respecting religion.
Thanks, Amanda. I'm looking forward to our conversation today, and it is clear, based upon the question we answered last week on our opening episode of this podcast, why we are doing this, that there is a good reason. As we talk about a Supreme Court case today, we're noting that there are several cases that affect religious liberty that the court is hearing this term, which is unusual, and that's happening in a blockbuster term where the court is going to be dealing with other important cases about abortion, Second Amendment, immigration, and LGBT issues.
So let's just dive in and start talking about Espinosa, one of the many cases, as you've noted, that the court's hearing. BJC is involved in cases like these before the Supreme Court, and our involvement is not new. For our listeners who have followed us for decades or maybe learning about BJC for the first time through this podcast series, I wanted to offer a quick review. BJC, or Baptist Joint Committee for Religious Liberty, first filed a Friend of the Court brief, also known as amicus curiae or amicus brief, back in 1947. And we've been involved in most every case impacting faith, freedom for all since then.
That 1947 case, for those who really follow these cases and think back of the history, goes back to the Everson case, which is a very important, fundamental case dealing with that kind of sets some important lines of jurisprudence about the separation of church and state and the accommodation or equal treatment of citizens without regard to religion in some aspect. So we have been at this a long time, and even I've been at it a long time personally.
That's right.
Now serving for the past 19 years, it's my privilege and honor to lead our legal department, working with our board and our history and our criteria for when we get involved in cases to decide when and how we will intervene in a case as a friend of the court. Sometimes we are the lead organization on a brief where we have a specific BJC message to put forth. Sometimes we come together with other people signing briefs. It just depends on the nature of the case and how we can best promote religious freedom for all and help the case.
But this particular case, Espinosa versus Montana Department of Revenue, obviously comes out of the state of Montana. And Montana has a constitutional provision known as a no-aid clause. It is not unique in that. 37 other states have similar provisions. And these clauses prohibit government aid to religious institutions, including schools. Montana's provision goes all the way back to the Montana Constitution of 1889, but then it was reenacted in 1972. So in 2015, the Montana legislature created a tax credit program for donations made to certain educational scholarship organizations. And individuals in Montana who donate to a nonprofit student scholarship organization get a dollar-for-dollar credit for their donation up to $150 per year. The scholarship organization would then use these funds at what's called a qualified education provider, which is really private schools in Montana. So Montana, seeing that there was a problem when you put this new state tax credit program up against their constitutional provision, passed a rule stating that the scholarships could not go to religious schools because to do so would violate the no-aid clause of their constitution. parents whose children had received some of these scholarships to go to a school called Stillwater Christian School then brought a suit to stop that rule from going into effect. And so this case worked its way up all the way up to the Montana Supreme Court. And when it got there, the Montana Supreme Court struck the entire tax credit program. So the parents then petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case, and the Trump administration joined the parents in their case, and that brings us to how BJC got involved in the case.
I want to back up for a minute as I talk about how the BJC got involved to mention this peculiarity about the law that we are dealing with here, where state laws similar to federal law, state constitution, similar to the federal constitution, have provisions to protect religious freedom for all. So this case made its way to the Supreme Court under the religion clauses of the federal religion clauses. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. But the question really is whether or not the federal constitution sort of overrides Montana's concern in upholding its state constitution. All right. BJC became involved because in this case, a prominent argument was that the federal constitution would not allow application of these state constitution provisions that also are intended to protect religious freedom. The brief that we filed in the Espinoza case, we think is important because it had two important points to make that we think are essential to understanding this case. We partnered with our good friend and an esteemed scholar, Professor Stephen Green, to provide a brief that made two big points. First, it defends the unique treatment of religion, and we can talk about that further. But the fact that religion is singled out both in the Montana Constitution and, as you said, other state constitutions, as well as the federal constitution, we needed to talk about that. Why is religion treated differently constitutionally? What is that for? What does it come from? And, you know, to make sure that we defend that idea and express why that's important. And secondly, we needed to counter a very confusing aspect of this case where some people argued that the Montana provision could not be followed, should not be followed, maybe struck entirely or at least struck in its application in this case because it was somehow rooted in anti-religious bias. You know, in simple terms, just saying that that to treat religious schools differently would be treating them badly in a way that shows animus toward religion. We needed to counter that narrative with the historical record and experience of defending religious liberty in a way that treats religion in special ways. So those are the two main points, that religion is singled out for special, unique treatment in a way that serves religious liberty. And secondly, this Montana's provision should not be dismissed, wiped out in some broad claim of anti-Catholic bigotry that some of the people who were supporting the petitioners really promoted.
And we were really fortunate, as you noted, to work with Professor Green on the brief. Listeners of the BJC podcast might remember he was a guest on our Christian Nationalism podcast series when we talk about the history of Christian nationalism in the United States. And so you can listen to him on that program as well. But we heard this attempt to really cloak these no-aid provisions in this idea of religious bigotry, even the way that they're sometimes labeled and called Blaine Amendments, remind us about Senator Blaine and that history and how that plays into these provisions.
Well, I think the main point that we wanted to put forward with the nation's leading expert on religious liberty and state constitutions, and particularly this period of anti-Catholic sentiment in the late 1800s, is Steve Green. So we wanted to partner with him to put forward the argument that should be made to the court that it should reject these attacks on no-aid provisions and instead uphold Montana's constitutional provision that preserves public funding for its public schools. So we were defending the no-aid principle in the Montana Constitution as an important part of our religious liberty history. when people talk about no aid provisions in state constitutions and call them Blaine Amendments, what they're doing is trying to tie these state provisions to a particular period in American history, time of increased Catholic immigration, and a real time of political upheaval, political debate about how you integrate new communities, religious communities, about religious differences that was occurring at the same time that the public schools were first beginning. And so there's a big complicated history about how these forces interacted and how they were expressed in an amendment that was put forward by Representative James Blaine that would have prevented any money going directly or indirectly, I believe, to religious schools. So when people say there's a bunch of Blaine amendments and we need to wipe out all the Blaine amendments, well, one, that expresses their idea to get rid of any barrier to keep government money going to religious institutions, religious schools, and two, to sort of sully the idea of that principle as if it was designed and all about some kind of harm to Catholics.
Yeah. And we saw the justices at the oral argument engaging in this conversation, you know, ostensibly in their questioning of the parties, but really between each other, I think, on the bench. We heard Justice Kavanaugh just say to one of the advocates, you know, could he really disagree that all of these provisions are rooted in grotesque religious bigotry against Catholics?
And quickly, yeah. The counsel for Montana said, that's wrong.
That's right.
That's wrong. And I think that's part of what we wanted to really emphasize in this case, is that the rule against government aid for religious institutions goes way, way back to our nation's founding, the founding era, and the fight for religious freedom in a way that has nothing to do and cannot be dismissed by that charge.
And then Justice Kagan really made those arguments later in the argument when she ticked off many of the reasons why the state of Montana might have wanted to do away with the program that had nothing to do with religious bigotry. She said, you might actually think that funding religion imposes costs and burdens on religious institutions themselves. You might think that taxpayers have conscientious objections to funding religion. You might think that funding religion creates divisiveness and conflict within a society, and that for all these reasons, funding religious activity is not a good idea, and that you would rather level down and fund no comparable activity, whether religious or otherwise, than fund both.
That's right. That was a really important statement during oral argument that I hope sort of at least put to the side this argument that somehow this case should be decided by a view of history that is impossible to really fit different states that all have their unique history, their unique religious makeup, their unique kind of mix of political factors that led to them incorporating the no-aid principle in their state constitution.
So we're going to take a quick break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how this case follows a case that BJC was involved in just a couple of years ago and what some of the other implications might be for the future. So continuing our conversation of the Espinosa case, we really have to go back 3 years now to the Trinity Lutheran case, because many people saw this case as coming out of the court's decision in that. In fact, Trinity Lutheran was invoked many times during argument. And Holly, you worked on a brief for BJC and Trinity Lutheran and wrote quite a bit about it after.
We did. So Trinity Lutheran was a really important case and one of those cases where we did need a BJC-specific brief, although our friends at UCC joined us too, which is often the case that other Christian and other religious groups want to join in to make our important religious perspective on separation very clear to the court. Trinity Lutheran is a case where, again, or really prior to this case, there was a state no-aid provision that was being applied in a way to prevent government funding to religious institutions. That was a church case, and We filed a brief in that case defending the no-aid rule. We did it, and it actually shows how the no-aid rule is so ingrained in our history and our jurisprudence. It's not just these no-aid provisions that came about in the development of public schools, but there were earlier versions called no-compelled support for religion, and that sounds familiar to all the Jefferson scholars out there. But there are other provisions that just say no public funds except for public purposes. So again, preserving state funds for state interests like public schools. All of that background fits in here in that you can try to wipe all that out and say that, you know, with some broad brush of history pointing to specific incidents, or you can look more deeply about why do we have this rule that keeps government from funding religion, and why would religious groups like BJC be for that rule that prevents government funding of religion? And it goes back to this history and this fight against the establishments of religion that our founders were so familiar with. In Trinity Lutheran, we had to defend that principle broadly with regard to a program that was pretty minor. It was a small grant program that the state of Missouri put in effect to promote recycling of tires. Apparently, if you leave tires around, it attracts rats and other rodents and problems that we don't want to happen. So to get rid of those, you need to find another purpose for it. Let's pulverize that rubber and let's put them on playgrounds, replacing the rocks or whatever people have on their playground. So they had a small grant program to get people to use, to recycle tires to help playgrounds, but it really got this issue before the court. Can no-aid provisions be applied without violating the First Amendment's Free Exercise Clause and the idea that we are all should be all equal citizens before the law and not treated differently because of our religious status? Okay, so Trinity Lutheran, known as the playground case, the court decided in a 7-2 decision that churches could not be excluded from that kind of program, a program that was designed to promote a secular purpose of improved playgrounds and improved recycling that was for the facilities outside the church. BJC's brief was to say, hey, it makes sense that states don't fund churches because churches are typically organized for explicit religious purposes. Why do you call yourself a church if you're not worshiping, gathering, studying scripture, really having a religious purpose? And so it made sense that the government would stay out of that. The court came to a different conclusion, but in doing so, had a kind of narrow decision. It was a 7-2 decision, but its ruling itself was narrow. I wrote a column in the Holman Report. It's called Trinity Lutheran Church, Decidedly Narrow but Deeply Troubling, in July-August edition of Report from the Capitol in 2017, that really goes through and explains more in detail that case and what's at issue. And it highlights the limited nature of that case. It was seen particularly in a footnote. The majority opinion was written by Chief Justice Roberts. And in the footnote, it said, this case involves express discrimination based on religious identity with respect to playground resurfacing. So what he was saying is, you know, there's really no need to leave Trinity Lutheran, a church, out when they applied for a grant for their playground and met these secular criteria about whether they could use this funding to improve their playground. But he goes on to say, in that footnote, we do not address religious uses of funding or other forms of discrimination. Now, we were pretty excited that at least that recognized that, like, we're talking about something big here. These state provisions that say no aid to religion are not, they're not just random exclusions. There's meat there. There's an importance there. And he puts that aside sort of for another day, recognizing that there's a difference between the clearly, what they would say, clearly secular material at issue in a playground versus other important religious aspects that the government typically does not fund. And Amanda, you might remember how that then came out.
It came out in the oral argument.
Yeah,
because
during Espinoza.
When we see footnotes like these, and you learn in law school, read the footnotes because they're really important, as this one. And this case really almost seemed to limit itself to these particular facts. Yeah. And we think that that was in part trying to get this large majority, 7-2, to sign on to one opinion. And I think that that suspicion was really borne out in oral argument when the Solicitor General was trying to really expand Trinity Lutheran, saying, stating the rule of Trinity Lutheran as you can't deny a generally available public benefit to an entity that's otherwise qualified based solely on its religious character. And he says that rule applies equally to schools as it does to playgrounds.
Wow.
And yeah.
And when he says schools, he's not talking about school playgrounds.
Yeah.
He's talking about schools and what they teach, and specifically the religious schools that would be receiving the funds in the Montana program.
That's right. And Justice Kagan very quickly said, Mr. Wall, I was one of the seven in Trinity Lutheran. And she says directly, but there seems to be a real difference in this case. And she says, we don't want to subsidize religious activity, in particular religious education. That's a far cry from Trinity Lutheran. So I think this is where we thought, if you can read the tea leaves from an oral argument, which is always somewhat dangerous, but if you were, this doesn't seem like this case, Espinosa, is likely to come down 7-2. Is that?
I would agree.
If I were just making guesses here.
I would agree. The oral argument firmly addressed Trinity Lutheran. I mean, you had the party representing the parents in the case that wanted the tax benefit for their benefit to go to religious schools, arguing that, you know, Trinity Lutheran controls open shut. And on the other side, you had very clear arguments that no, this is not about a benefit to a secular program having nothing to do with religion. This is money that would fund religious education. I remember that at some point during an oral argument, I think it was Justice Breyer who noted religious education is one of the primary ways that we exercise religion because it allows people to continue faith formation in the next generation. So, yeah, that's not just like making your playground a little bit softer.
Yeah. And Breyer said, there's nothing more religious except perhaps for the service in the church itself than religious education. That's how we create a future for our religion. So you see that, again, both Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan were in the majority in Trinity Lutheran. They may be thinking about this case and its implications differently. I do think even though we don't think it's likely to be a 7-2 opinion, a lot of court watchers still think that the people who brought the case, the parents and the government, the federal government, are likely to prevail in this case. If they do, I think the question is, what are the implications for religious liberty? If we really are to think about funding religious schools just like we fund public schools, what implications does that mean for religious freedom of those schools and more broadly for our country?
It would be a huge development if the court went that far. I think always the question is, are they going to decide this, how they're going to decide it, and is it going to be narrowly or broadly? So one of the problems that we could see in Trinity Lutheran, despite the footnote, there was some troubling language toward the end thrown in and throughout that sort of undercut the reason for the no funding rule, right? So even though Trinity Lutheran didn't go so far, we kind of saw this reasoning. And so we're concerned about then the next step, how far the court might go in this case. So I think the real issue is, will the court see this distinction that we just talked about, where Kagan pointed out a difference between a playground resurfacing and religious education in the schools? Will the court note that, and will that be important to their decision, or will there be a majority that continues in this idea that any time that you treat religion differently, you're treating it discriminatorily in a way that harms this idea of equal treatment without regard to religious status? Of course, we hope that the court will recognize these differences. Religion's treated in a unique way in our constitutional law to avoid its establishment and to avoid interference in free exercise. And so while we don't discriminate based upon religious status, We are equal citizens without regard to religion. Those are important principles. At the same time, we recognize that religious practice, religious worship, education, proselytization, these are unique religious aspects that the government can recognize as different and to keep out of. That's what the separation of religion and government is about, is protecting religious liberty by keeping a certain distance.
And keeping a distance also means sometimes that we treat religious institutions, religious schools differently, and that means sometimes they're given special exceptions from other laws that apply in other contexts. And the court is going to consider such a difference this term when it thinks about exemptions from federal employment discrimination laws that apply to religious schools. And so I think that you are right. We have to wait for the decision and how it's structured and how narrowly tailored it is to these facts as Trinity Lutheran was. But the more and more we chip away at this idea that we have to, we might be required in some ways to fund religion or religious activity, the harder it is to justify those exemptions from laws that apply to other organizations.
It does seem contradictory to argue that religion is just like everything else when you want a financial benefit, but that it is uniquely special and deserves every accommodation when a law is being applied to you that you don't like.
So there are a lot of implications for religious liberty. I think there are also implications for public education. Anything else on religious liberty before we move to that?
Yeah, I think actually relatedly, I think a really important matter that, like we're saying, will come down to how broadly the court writes or not is will they focus on that you have to treat religion the same if you create a particular kind of program, like in Trinity Lutheran and maybe in the underlying facts of the Montana tax credit case where they're having an incentive to give to private schools and, treat religion like other ones there, or in a broader sense that you would always treat religion like everything else, which of course would be a tremendous, terrible development in the law. And I think Justice Breyer saw it, and it does relate to what implications this case would have for the funding of public education. Justice Breyer repeatedly asked questions about why you could treat or when and why you would treat religion differently. Part of the argument from those who said that this was discriminatory, that it would violate free exercise to not fund these private religious schools, was that this was almost like race discrimination, that this was all animus and treating religion differently in a bad way. And Breyer kept saying, well, that's surely not the case. Well, he didn't say. He's kind of trying to pull it out of the advocates. Could that be the case? Would that mean that if we have a public school system and we fund a public school system, as we do as a country and as our states do, do you also have to fund a private religious schools? And through his line of questioning, finally got to the point of what's different is the Establishment Clause, right? And that we do treat religion in a unique way because it is uniquely protected in the First Amendment. But as you noted, would this case have big implications for public education? It certainly would if the court says that states that spend money on public schools also have to fund private schools, including private religious schools.
And we have seen proliferation of voucher programs in states and state legislatures, sometimes called school choice provisions by those who are pushing them. And it was noteworthy when the court heard oral argument back on January 22nd that Education Secretary Betsy DeVos was in the courtroom that day. She has been a proponent of private education in general, private religious education, and state voucher programs to support that. She was also, of course, at the State of the Union address on February 4th. Our listeners probably remember the coverage for the drama, reality TV aspects of that, the theater of it that came both from the president and the Speaker of the House that night. But I don't want us to miss an important policy proposal that got quite a bit of time in the speech. President Trump discussed what he calls opportunity scholarships, and a provision for this was in his 2020 budget proposal, and it is again in the 2021 fiscal year budget proposal. It is very much like what the state of Montana had as far as setting up a program where there's a scholarship organization that a taxpayer can give to and get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit, and then that organization funds scholarships at religious schools. But in Montana, remember, it was a $150 cap for each taxpayer to get that credit. That is a very small tax credit and incentive. Under the president's proposal, an individual could give up to 10% of an individual's taxable income, and a corporation could give up to 5% of its taxable income and get a dollar-for-dollar tax credit. How much does this cost, you ask? $5 billion a year less in tax income would come to the federal government. So this is a huge expansion of that proposal, of that idea on a national level.
Yes, I imagine for Betsy DeVos and other diehard voucher proponents that these no aid provisions and the idea that BJC supports that government should not fund religion and therefore, you know, also treat religion specially in other ways, is just sort of a pesky thing in the way of what they're really getting at, which is this broader agenda about funding of religion schools, kind of doing away with the public-private distinctions.
Yeah, so if the Supreme Court would rule in their favor, and again, they joined with the parents in this case, yes, and actually argue before the case, the court, if they did away with this rule or said that these provisions somehow violated the federal constitution, then we might see a lot of states pushing proposals like this federal proposal. I think it's good news for those who are concerned about funding like this going to religious schools and those who support public education that this proposal doesn't seem to have any legs in Congress right now. But I think it really shows a window into what some of the reasons behind this advocacy might be. And then just another curious turn in this whole story, at the State of the Union, the president actually announced that a young girl from Philadelphia would be getting one of these scholarships. Her name is Janiyah Davis. And it looked like it was a surprise to the student and her mother.
Highlighted the address that, like, oh, wait, it's going to happen now.
Yeah. Well, we find out later that Janiyah already attends a competitive charter school, the Math, Science, and Technology Community Charter in Philadelphia, that her mother was somewhat perplexed about why they were selected to get a scholarship, and that the federal government's not funding her scholarship, but that Secretary DeVos is funding it out of her private funds.
Right.
So the way that all these things are linked, I think it's important not to miss some of these connections and and to keep this in mind when we watch for a decision coming down later this term. And for those listening who want to learn more about the Espinosa case, you can go to bjconline.org/Espinosa. You can read the BJC brief and articles about this, and you can also go to our case archives page to read more about Trinity Lutheran. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about respecting religion and what we've been seeing, reading, thinking about this week.
All right, we're back now for our last segment of Respecting Religion, where we look for ways of seeing religion and religious liberty in our world around us. I was thinking this week, Amanda, we've had some conversations passing over the last month, but we just got through award season and the Academy Awards. And I remember you from a long time ago that used to have a tradition of Academy Award parties. But somehow I think with your job and your young child.
I was lamenting. This is the first year. Yes, I used to have parties, then I would go to parties, then I would just watch the Academy Awards. This year, I did not even get to watch the awards ceremony.
And then, not only that, it's been hard to find time just to see the top movies. And there are some, and we hopefully will get to them in other episodes to talk about, that do have important religious themes and that have sparked conversation about religion in public life. But instead, we've sort of been crowded out by continuing news of religion and religious liberty here in Washington.
Yeah. Last week, in our first episode, we promised our listeners this would be a fun segment. And I do hope in the future that we have some more lighthearted topics. But frankly, right now, the world around us is not giving us a lot of lighthearted topics to discuss. So when we talk about how we're seeing respecting religion and religion respected in the world around us this week, I have to just look across the street from our offices to the Supreme Court and see that they granted yet another case impacting religious liberty. Thankfully for next term, this isn't something we have to expect oral argument and a decision in the next few months, but it is a pretty landmark case. People are already calling it the marquee case of next term, which I think they might be speaking too soon because the Supreme Court still has a lot of months left and can accept some more interesting cases as well. But this case is called Fulton versus City of Philadelphia. And it raises the question that comes up a lot about how religious social service organizations interact with the government, all levels of government,
that's
right, in this case, city government, and the regulations that they bring to it. There's a lot of commentary out there already anticipating that, you know, where this case might go. I think it's too early to say that, but it certainly involves religion and how religion is respected and how the religious objections of the particular organization at play here, the Catholic organization at play here, has to do with how they deliver services related to the city's foster care system.
Right. It relates to that question we were talking about earlier and whether or not religion can be treated differently to its benefit, to its exception, while being treated favorably in the same when it comes to financial entanglements with the government. So that case also will touch on something that really is affecting conversations about religious liberty, and we know making sometimes these conversations difficult, and that is this tension between non-discrimination laws, particularly those protecting LGBTQ people, and claims of religious liberty and claims of, you know, religious exceptions based upon religious views. So that will definitely add to or continue the court's taking on important issues affecting religious liberty. It seems also the court was in the news as we continue to hear more about relationships between the branches of government and challenges before us. There was more news, too, about the tension between the executive branch and the judicial branches yesterday.
I think it's never a good sign when the president is calling out Supreme Court justices in his tweets, as he did this week following a dissent from Justice Sonia Sotomayor in a case, Wolf versus Cook County, and the decision by the court to grant a nationwide stay of another court's decision to put on hold a new government policy. And Justice Sotomayor really took issue with this practice that has become more and more frequent by the Trump administration of asking the court to stay lower court decisions pending review. Usually the cases work their way up through the system and the Supreme Court waits to weigh in until comes up to their level. These emergency stay applications come without argument, without the benefit of much briefing, and the court is asked to rule on them. And Justice Sotomayor said, it's hard to say what is more troubling, that the government would seek this extraordinary relief seemingly as a matter of course, or that the court would grant it. So this is a pretty public disagreement between the two branches of government going on.
I think it really underscores what we said about taking this time in this podcast to talk about important matters of religious liberty and how they are reflected in legal developments from a policy perspective as well as in court cases. that we have to do that because there's so much going on. It is a unique time. The stories that I read related to that event yesterday, Sotomayor's dissent, just said that there's an increased number of these emergency appeals, right? That's affecting the court and how much the court can handle, and something to take note of.
But there's more going on in the world than just the Supreme Court.
That's right. And particularly about thinking about religion in ways that we see that in the news and culture. I was struck this week with the big story has been, of course, the coronavirus. And the clear story is that it is spreading. It is continuing. The news at the time of this taping was that the latest new concerns are outbreaks in Italy and in South Korea and Iran. And I heard some good reporting talking about the specific challenges about how it's come up in these different countries. But I was particularly struck about two stories that told me something about how religion is understood and criticized, how it's treated fairly and unfairly. And related to the coronavirus stories, one is that there are more than 200 cases in South Korea, of course, a country that's close to China, so you might fear that would be a place where it could happen. But more than half of those cases have been tied to a particular religious group with practices of being in tight quarters together. And to me, that story and questions arising out of that help us think about religion as expressed in so many different ways. So some have used this to criticize that particular religious group, to raise questions about their practices and whether they should even be allowed to exist. And then that can lead questions to say, well, what do they do? And what are they? And to maybe think more critically about religion, but allows us to think more critically about religion, how it is special and should be protected, and how at other times it has to be treated like everything else for compelling governmental interests like safety. Okay, so without going into the details, without being an expert on that particular religious institution or case, it really came to mind in the reporting of this very serious story about coronavirus. Then there was a really beautiful story, I thought, that instead of raising suspicions and concerns about religion, kind of showed the way religion operates in such an important way in society. This was a story about a New York City church fighting fears over the coronavirus. NPR did a story about this that actually was, I think, came out of a Christianity Today story about the New York Chinese Alliance Church. You know, Amanda, that's in New York near NYU.
Yeah.
So we probably would assume they have a very diverse population, including a lot of Chinese students, and they may be affected by the coronavirus and have particular worries. And what's so interesting about this story is that one of the leaders of the church was Stephen Coe, who wrote in Christianity Today about arguing that this was a time to come together, he said that as a pastor, he had a calling to care for those who were vulnerable and importantly, to combat stigma and xenophobia. Now, this pastor was particularly suited for this because he had a background in infectious disease. Mm. So I recommend that story to people to think about the important role that religion plays in caring for others, but also caring for people in their fears and being open to communities that are hurting and suffering and fearfulness. And that is can be consistent also with doing important things to take care to prevent the spread of the virus.
That story really reminds me of our friend, Reverend Dr. George Mason at Wilshire Baptist Church.
Oh, yes.
And that he had a member of his church who had contracted the Ebola virus when that was an epidemic and a real cause for concern and fear in the United States. And the way that he was able to show a Christian witness and community in that crisis seems very much like what this pastor is doing for this community.
That's right. So religion is called on to serve and to help our culture and society respond in compassionate ways, as well as it raises questions about, as we respect religious groups, how do they also sometimes have to be regulated, or they can't be totally insulated and shouldn't be totally insulated from civil society and things that we need to protect the greater good.
Yeah. So we're finding religion in all areas, even on a very heavy news week. This week we can hope for a little bit of a lighter conversation for our final segment next week.
Yes.
Well, that will do it for this episode of Respecting Religion. Join us again next week when we'll be discussing religious expression in the public schools. We invite you to join us each week on Respecting Religion. New episodes in the series will be released each Thursday. You can find the BJC podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. We're on all the major platforms. Subscribe to the BJC podcast so you don't miss an episode. And let us know what you think of the podcast on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BJC on the Hill, and you can follow me on Twitter at Amanda Tyler BJC. I also encourage you to take a moment to learn more about BJC. Visit our website at bjconline.org to learn more about how we've been protecting faith freedom for all since 1936. And join us again next week for a new conversation respecting religion.